Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, a look back at the Saint Egidio International Encounter in the Spirit of Assisi, which brought together nearly 300 religious and civic leaders in the Polish city of Krakow this week. And Jill Bevilacqua presents episode 11 of The Vatican Centuries, our dramatization of the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican. Religious faith has the potential to lead people away from the abyss of war, hatred and fear, and onto the path of peace. That was the message contained in a final statement signed by hundreds of religious leaders from across the world, gathered in the Polish city of Krakow for the annual Saint Egidio meeting in the Spirit of Assisi. This year, the meeting coincided with commemorations marking the 70th anniversary of the start of the Second World War, and the nearly 300 participants discussed progress and setbacks that have taken place since then in the search for lasting peace among peoples and nations. The gathering included an unprecedented interfaith pilgrimage to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Nazi death camp, a powerful symbol of their commitment to dialogue and reconciliation as the only way to overcome conflicts in countries around the world today. The colourful encounter took place from September the 6th to the 8th and included heads of state and other civic authorities keen to show their support for this international prayer meeting, begun by Pope John Paul II at the first Assisi Gathering of Prayer for Peace in October 1986. Among the civic leaders present at the Krakow meeting was the Portuguese president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, who spoke to journalists and explained why he wanted to support the Saint Egidio initiative.
I come to this conference organized by Community Saint Egidio because I believe it's more important than ever to show our commitment to peace and to development in the world. It has a significant special meaning that this meeting takes place here in Krakow, in Poland, the country that has most suffered with the war. It's also the hometown of this great personality that was John Paul II. And the fact that we make this meeting here, when we are evoking the start of Second World War and also some years after the last enlargement of the European Union, as, of course, a very important and powerful meaning in terms of the contribution that Europe can make to peace. A European project is a project based on the idea of reconciliation. And I believe that more than ever, we should make that a project also that serves as inspiration for other parts of the world. I think the European model of society is a source of inspiration for other parts of the world. We are now living in a union that comprises 27 countries and that were former enemies and that together work for common values. And this is the meaning of Krakow today. This is the meaning of this event, and that's why I came here to express my deep commitment to those values and also the idea that Europe can give a very important contribution globally for those values.
Do you think that the enlargement of the European Union toward East could be a good tool of reconciliation between those countries which are not yet completely reconciled?
This last enlargement was already a very important contribution because in a very short period, from 15, we became 27 member states. It was by far the biggest enlargement in European history. And so it's only natural that we are now mainly in a consolidation phase. But I think we should keep all our commitments towards other countries through our enlargement policy. And before we are in a situation to incorporate other countries, and before they are also in a situation to accept all the conditions of European membership, I think we should develop the instruments we have in the neighborhood policy. We have now a strong neighborhood policy, and recently we have developed it in two main dimensions. One is the Union for the Mediterranean, the other one is the Eastern Partnership. And this is what we can do. For instance, to Ukraine, we have offered now the most ambitious ever program of association. The European Union cannot expand indefinitely, and now we are in a phase of consolidation. But I think at the same time we should offer those countries the possibilities to be closely linked with the European Union, not only economically, but also politically, through that mechanism of partnership, in this case the Eastern Partnership.
EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso. Pope Benedict XVI sent a message to the meeting via satellite link-up, saying religious leaders must promote forgiveness and reconciliation. Speaking from the city of Viterbo, where he was making a pastoral visit, he said the key to peace is the ability to transmit to younger generations a culture marked by love, solidarity and respect for others.
In my opinion, one of the reasons for the failure of peace initiatives in my part of the world, in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land, has been a failure to engage religion.
Rabbi David Rosen heads the American Jewish Committee's Department for Interreligious Affairs and has been a regular participant at the St. Egidio meeting since that first Assisi Day of Prayer back in 1986. He sat down with Vatican Radio's correspondent in Krakow, Stefano Duszynski, to talk about how to further the dialogue between religious and political leaders.
Religion is not the same thing in every part of the world. Religious leadership does not have the same role in every part of the world. In some places, it really is the leading force. Other places, it's, if you like, an underlying social force. And in our part of the world, in the Middle East, especially Muslim and Jewish leadership is to some degree subject to political authority. But the fact that it does not provide prophetic leadership does not mean that it is insignificant, because it still represents the core identities of the peoples involved, and therefore it's necessary to engage it. And this is very difficult for secular politicians to understand. Most secular politicians are suspicious of religion, if not hostile to religion, and therefore we have to work hard to overcome their prejudices, as well as the capacity of the religious leadership to understand that they need to be engaged. This is a process, and we have to keep working at it. Unfortunately, those like myself who are working on this process are pioneers, and this is a new development which some politicians grasp. I would actually say Well, in some parts of the world, this is an understanding that comes more naturally. But in many parts of the world, it's very difficult to get this message across. And we just have to be determined to work at it harder and harder.
Talking about one of the themes of the meeting, the beginning of the World War II, and its main symbol here in Poland, which is Auschwitz. Auschwitz is still a place where, of course, it is symbol of horrible genocide and Holocaust of Jewish people, but it's still a place which can divide. Why it is like that?
Well, allow me, before I address this very important question, to also point to the fact that to be here in Krakow, in Poland, 70 years after the Second World War, is itself a manifestation of triumph, of hope over destruction. And that's very much personified in the person of the late John Paul II. And nations that were enemies and were totally filled with hate for one another now cooperate, and even there is warmth between them, and you have now such a totally new spirit. So just being here at this particular moment in time is a testimony to the triumph of hope over destruction. Now, with regards to Auschwitz specifically, all memories, as almost all aspects of life, have their positive and negative potential. The Bible, Pentateuch, the Torah, emphasizes the importance of memory. We are always told, remember, you were a stranger, you were a slave, you suffered in Egypt. Why are we meant to remember it? Because the Torah, the Bible, says, so that you will be sensitive towards other strangers, towards other marginalized people, and that you will therefore develop a positive moral lesson from it. According to Jewish tradition, Over 36 times we are reminded that we were strangers in the land of Egypt and to be sensitive to others. Why so many times? The Talmud says, because there is the danger that you may use your history to be insensitive instead of to be sensitive. People can go through a traumatic experience and say, I've been such terrible trauma, why should I care for somebody else? Nobody cared about me. Or I am still wounded and I'm still hurting and still nobody cares about me. They still hate me, therefore I turn my back on them because they turn their back on me. So any experience can have its positive and its negative dimensions. And when people are wounded and they are in pain, and pain can last a very long time, when they can be victims of trauma. So the challenge is how to ensure that memory does not imprison you, but memory inspires you, motivates you to be more expansive, more compassionate, more engaging. So this is a perennial challenge. It's not just in Auschwitz. It's in every experience of pain and of suffering. But because Auschwitz embodies, as you said, the ultimate suffering, but unparalleled, arguably, in the whole of human history, so the capacity both to imprison and to inspire is greater perhaps than anywhere else. And it's really important for our communities, for the Jewish community, to see our leaders engaged with other religions and with other communities at Auschwitz to emphasize that here, yes, there are particular lessons, but there are above all universal lessons that we must bring to as guidance for humanity at large.
Talking about historical memory, it seems sometimes that Europe has a very short historical memory. Especially we had examples with last European elections, there was a very strong affirmation of extremist, right-wing extremist parties, anti-Semitic parties. What do you think about anti-Semitism in Europe? Is it growing? Is it still dangerous? It is a real danger to the peace, actually, again.
You know, somebody once said, anti-Semitism is like every other prejudice, except more so. And therefore, as a general rule, we can say anti-Semitism reflects a general prejudicial atmosphere, a broad xenophobia. It has also been said that Jews are the litmus test of a society's health or lack of health, because Jews are, as a minority, have historically been the classical other, and therefore they are, if you like, the canary in the mine. They can give a reflection of the condition of society. But I don't think it's anything inherently different from the status of other minorities. Yes, of course, there's a special also theological dimension to it, but I don't think that that's the major manifestation we have today in Europe. Today in Europe is mainly a reflection of xenophobia, of extremist nationalist resurgence. All of this simply reflects fear. So what are people fearful of today? Well, part of it has to do with the financial crisis. Part of it has to do with an economic downturn. People are fearful for their jobs, for their income, for their security. And therefore they seek scapegoats. And within this context, then it is the Jew is the traditional classical scapegoat. So the resurgence of anti-Semitism and of xenophobia should be of great concern in Europe. It is definitely a worrying phenomenon. However, I hope I don't sound too Pollyannish or naive when I say that I think that Europe today is basically extremely healthy. And the vast majority of Europeans do not identify with these sentiments. And the very fact that there is a reaction on the part of majority of concern when these extremist groups gain significant political support is, I think, if you like, the positive side of the negative of the coin. So I'm concerned, yes, and I think every good person should be concerned, but I don't think we are facing anything like the kind of evils we have seen in the historic past. Basically, I think Europe has a good ethical underpinning.
Nevertheless, it is alarming that this kind of politics attracts especially the youngsters. It must be a lack of communication between the older generation and the youngster generation. They were not able to teach to the youngsters the mistakes of the past or some other reason.
Well, of course, that's true throughout history, and it's a truism that the young generally do not learn from the old as much as they should, that young tend also to rebel against an older generation. They wish to, if you like, put their own seal on society. And another aspect of youth tends to be a simplistic black and white reading of conditions and therefore of alternatives, and a simplistic perception that one can resolve complicated issues in superficial ways. And this will take time to be able to learn that that is not the case. But I think in most examples in the post-war, Second World War era, when these reactions have taken place, there have tended to be counter-reactions that have counterbalanced them in due course. So, again, I hope I'm not sounding too naive. I do agree that it is a worrying phenomenon. I certainly think governments must take it seriously. Education must be a central focus to educate for respect for human dignity and for diversity. Religions have a special role to play. But I'm confident that the majority of both of civil society and of religious institutions will succeed in redressing the imbalance.
It's easy to have a dialogue among those who wants a dialogue, who are keen to have a dialogue. Is it possible to have a dialogue with those who refuse the dialogue, actually, with those who hate the other?
Well, obviously, it's by definition not possible to dialogue with those who refuse to have any encounter. But I think between those who are engaged in the dialogue and those who refuse to have any contact with others, there is a very large grey area of people who are not engaged in dialogue, may even be suspicious of it, but can be accessed. And this is the skill of how to be able to access them. When people ask me what I do, very often I like to make a flippant response that I'm a translator. Because my work in interreligious dialogue and engagement is always translating, even if I'm speaking the same language. Because I have to be able to connect with people where they are and in terms of their worldview. So I will not speak in the same way to an extreme conservative the way I would speak to a liberal. The nature of language, I need to communicate with them, and therefore there's no point in alienating them at the outset. And if I speak to somebody who comes from a particular religious tradition, to the degree that I know that religious tradition, I will try to speak in their terms of reference. Now, this applies a great deal to cultures that are not socially totally compatible or comfortable with Western modernity. And I'm thinking in particular of Islamic immigrant societies within it that are taking time to find their place and their way within the broader society. Now, there are some reactions that are extreme reactions and that see themselves as hostile to Western liberal society and even in conflict with it. And some of these then lead to violent manifestations as we see in certain Islamicist extremist groups. In such cases, obviously, every society must protect itself and you need effective intelligence and law enforcement. But the vast majority are not extremist in a violent way. And they might still experience a degree of alienation and of fear and maybe even of hostility. This does not mean they cannot be engaged. And I believe that especially if you understand their codes, try to speak in their language, there is enough of a richness and of profound ethical teachings in all our religions that you can connect with those teachings, you can actually give individuals an understanding of how they should view things differently, of how they should engage in a different way, and above all of how they can make a constructive contribution to society. The more people feel that they are part of the society, the more they will seek to make a constructive engagement. Those who are hostile and even violent reflect an attitude that does not see themselves as part of that society. So we have it in our interest, our existential interests, to make sure that communities feel that they are part of the general society as much as possible. And we do that through showing respect, through trying to engage them on their own language, but not through forfeiting our own security and our own interests, always protecting that very effectively.
Rabbi David Rosen there, head of the American Jewish Committee's Department for Interreligious Affairs, speaking to Vatican Radio's Stefano Lushinsky. And now Jill Bevilacqua presents the next episode in her drama series, The Vatican Centuries, a look at the people and places who made up the history of the Vatican. Episode 11 is entitled The Pilgrims.
There must have been many pilgrims who came to Rome in the Dark Ages, but left no trace of their visits.
The Vatican was probably the goal for many an English pilgrim, but it was after the restoration of Christianity in England by the initiative of Pope Gregory that pilgrimages to Rome became a tradition.
It was in the year 596 that Pope Gregory sent Augustine to England and later Paulinus to help Augustine in his mission. Paulinus spent 24 years in Kent, after which he evangelized the southern parts of Northumbria. The daughter of King Ethelbert of Kent, who had become a Christian, married Edwin of Northumbria, and so Paulinus found the way smoothed for him.
Augustine and Paulinus were not bringing Christianity to England for the first time. England had been Christian. A British church had grown up and sent its bishops to the early councils. England had produced saints and heretics, monks and martyrs.
But when the Roman legions abandoned the island, and during the long struggle with the Saxon invaders, the English church found itself isolated from the rest of Christendom. British Christianity lost its hold. For at least two centuries, the faith languished, kept alive only by the periodical appearance of champions like David, Patrick, and Columba. For the rest, England was plunged into heathen darkness.
When King Edwin gathered his chief advisers together to discuss the question of Christianity, the heathen high priest, Coifi, agreed to adopt the new religion if the Christian God would show favours to his followers. Then another counsellor spoke. His words are recorded by Bede.
The present life of man, O king, seems to me, in comparison of that time which is unknown to us, like to the swift flight of a sparrow through the room wherein you sit at supper in winter, with your commanders and ministers, and a good fire in the midst, whilst the storms of rain and snow prevail abroad. The sparrow, I say, flying in at one door and immediately out at another, whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry storm. But after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight into the dark winter from which he had emerged. So this life of man appears for a short space. But of what went before, or what is to follow, we are utterly ignorant. If, therefore, this new doctrine contains something more certain, it seems justly to deserve to be followed.
The earliest recorded English visitor to Rome was Benedict Biscop in 653. Then a young man of 25, Benedict was to return to Rome many more times. He came of a noble Northumbrian family and began life as a courtier, but later became a monk and founded the monasteries of Wearmouth and Jarrow. He was a man of wide learning and culture, and from Rome he brought back many treasures for the English churches, books, altar vessels, paintings and vestments. His pupil, Bede, was later to draw on Benedict's collection of books when writing his History of the English Church. In the year 680, with the permission of Pope Agatho, Benedict brought over John, the archcantor of St. Peter's, to teach his monks liturgical chant, as used in Rome.
Not long after Benedict Biscop first arrived in Rome, came Wilfrid, his countryman and contemporary. Wilfrid had entered monastic life at 14 and studied under the monks of Lindisfarne. but when he reached maturity, he began to be dissatisfied with the way of life taught there, and decided to go to Rome to see, as Bede puts it, what ecclesiastical and monastic customs were in use at the Apostolic See.
When Wilfrid arrived in Rome, Bede writes, he devoted himself to constant prayer and study of church matters, and won the friendship of the Archdeacon Boniface, who was also a papal counsellor. Under his guidance, he learned each of the Gospels in turn, and the correct method of calculating Easter, while through his tutor he came to understand many other things relating to church order, about which he had known nothing in his own country.
Wilfrid was one of the chief spokesmen at the Council of Whitby in 664, which finally settled the Paschal question, which had long been a matter of dispute between the Roman and the Celtic churches.
Wilfrid, like Benedict Biscop, returned to Rome several times, but for different reasons. As Bishop of York, he was frequently absent from his see on missionary work, and this led to attempts to supplant him. Wilfrid appealed to Rome, going there in person and setting his case before the Pope. To Pope Agatho on the first occasion, and 5 years later to Pope John VI. Agatho heard his case, acquitted him, and declared him worthy of his bishopric. John likewise stated that he had been unjustly condemned and recommended that he be restored to his see. When Wilfrid arrived back in England with letters from the Pope to this effect, he was supported by the archbishops and allowed to live the remaining years of his life in peace.
Before the 7th century ended, one of Wilfrid's converts was to make a spectacular gesture, which started a tradition in the century that followed. Caedwalla, king of the West Saxons, abdicated after only 2 years' reign and travelled to Rome to be baptised. For having learned, Bede tells us, that the road to heaven lies open to mankind only through baptism, he wished to obtain the particular privilege of receiving the cleansing of baptism at the shrine of the Blessed Apostles. At the same time, he hoped to die shortly after his baptism and pass from this world to everlasting happiness.
Caedwalla's wish was granted. He was baptized by Pope Sergius I on Holy Saturday, 689, and given the name of Peter. Only 10 days later, while still wearing his white baptismal robes, he fell ill and died.
He was buried in the loggia of Old St. Peter's, and his epitaph reads as follows.
Here was laid Caedwalla, also called Peter, King of the Saxons. A throne, riches, offspring, powerful kingdoms, home, all that the bravery of his forefathers, all that Caedwalla himself, mighty in war, had amassed, all these he forsook for the love of God, that he might behold Peter and the abode of Peter, he a royal stranger.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua presenting episode 11 of The Vatican Centuries. And she'll be back on the air, of course, at the same time next week with episode 12. That's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.